Hello, and welcome to a special edition of our show, Herstory.
On the rocks!
With Katie.
And Allie.
Usually we would be hanging out, just the two of us, with a couple of cocktails, talking about famous women in history, but sometimes we like to talk to people who are writing about women in history.
We have a very special guest here with us today, Kelly Hill. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We're so excited to have you. Kelly is a writer from Louisville, Kentucky, who has earned her PhD from the University of Louisville and her MFA in fiction from Spalding University. She's here with us today to chat about her first novel, A Home for Friendless Women. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I grew up in Texas and went to school there, college, all that. And then when I decided to get my PhD, I ended up moving to Louisville. So you have to say it Louisville, like your mouth is full of bourbon. That's how we all say it here. and it's a very fantastic little liberal city in the middle of a conservative state. So it's a lot like Austin in the 90s, if you ever visited there. Sort of the blueberry in a gazpacho state is how some people say it. And it's just really easy to live there. There's lots of things to do. There's no traffic. I'm always like scared to talk it up because I don't want a bunch of people moving there. But it's such an interesting city, and not a lot of people know that it actually has this really great literary scene and cultural scene and just a lot of really fun things happening in this little place in Kentucky.
Oh, I love that. Well, we're so excited to get into Louisville.
There you go. That's right.
And your book. But first, we have to introduce the cocktail we made for it. So this is called A Home for Friendless Women. And I wanted to incorporate a lot of ingredients that you would have in like a cocktail you were making for like a girl's night. Obviously, some of the things that were happening were more traumatic than normal girl's night, but... But this is red wine, Aperol, orange liqueur, and then you top the whole thing off with flavored sparkling water. I did yuzu mandarin, and you top it off with fresh basil, and it looks delicious.
So pretty. Pretty.
Yes. Cheers.
I only have my water here. It's like, yeah. Here. But yours looks much more fun.
It's delicious.
So, I think we want to start for our listeners by setting the scene for your book. What time period are we in? What part of the country? And what was life like for women?
So this is set in the late Victorian era. So the bulk of the book is late 19th and then early 20th century. And it takes place in Louisville at a place that was actually called the Home for Friendless Women. And there were a lot of these institutions across the country. So friendless was a euphemism for being pregnant and unmarried. I originally thought this was a home maybe for adult women who just needed some girlfriend time. And sadly, that was not the case. But there was a lot of these homes across the U.S. So if especially a white middle-class woman found herself pregnant, not married, she could be sent to this home. They were mostly run by Protestant women. And the idea was that they were going to reform these fallen, sinful women. The way they would do that is ask them to be Christians and then also give them a lot of hard work. So sort of this idea of like, you can redeem yourself by working a lot and repenting for your sinful ways.
Right.
So not a great time to be a woman. You couldn't vote. You didn't have a ton of bodily autonomy. Mm-hmm. I don't know how different that is from today, but right. We can maybe touch on that later.
So the story focuses on the lives of three women, Ruth, Belle, and Minnie. So let's start off with Ruth. She is dealing with a sexual assault on a college campus. I mean, what is she like, and how much do we know of what would have really happened to a girl like this in real life?
Yeah, that's such a great question. So, and Ruth didn't really exist, right? So like this is historical fiction. So large chunks of this come from my imagination and research I did. So like when I looked through the books, that the home actually had from, you know, the 1870s and the 1880s. The women who ran the home would leave these really cryptic notes, and they often wouldn't even give the women who were staying their names. So they might just be like, a woman who claims to be of good standing has shown up at the home, or this woman is behaving in a really pernicious fashion, right? So they wouldn't always say who they were. Occasionally, they might give them names. So I just imagine this was a time period when a large number of women, not a large number, but more women were starting to go to college. And unfortunately, campus sexual assaults happen today. And I figured surely they happened back then. And I think I would not say that women today are heavily believed, but I really suspected that in that time period, nobody actually cared why you were pregnant and unmarried. So I just assumed a large number of women would have been assaulted. And so I wanted to have that character be in the home, but I also didn't want her to just be a survivor of sexual assault. Like, I didn't want that to be the defining moment of who she was, that it would have been one thing that obviously impacted her, but it wasn't who she was.
Yeah. And so our next character is Belle, and Belle is a queer sex worker. What is her life like, and how is she treated in society and also in the home?
Yeah, so a lot of women came to the home from brothels. I found this article that said in the 1870s, when there were 70,000 people living in Louisville, there were 79 brothels. So just a huge number of brothels. And a lot of the women in the home did seem to come from brothels or houses of ill fame, as they called them. They had lots of euphemisms for brothels. And I think that sex work was probably talked about a little bit similarly as it was today. I think that like Gen Z is having a really different conversation about sex work and OnlyFans and having a more nuanced conversation. I certainly feel like when I was growing up, sex work was not a very complex conversation that people wanted to have. It was much more about villainizing the woman who is engaging in sex work. And I think that was very much the case then, that people who were prostitutes at that time, they were seen as like depraved, fallen women who liked it. There was no idea of like why someone might enter sex work in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a little bit about her queer identity? How is that affecting her story? And were you researching real women who existed at the time and maybe in hiding?
Yeah, so Belle was actually named in the record book. She was like a misbehaving enough lady that they were like, we're going to name her. And they described her as being this pernicious influence on this other woman in the home named Rose. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, when I read that, I just thought like, that sounds like Victorian code for they were lesbians. I have no idea if that's true or not. But I think that it was a really hard time to be queer in that time period. But I wanted to create a world where it wasn't for them. Like, yeah. That's where the like imagination part came in, where I thought, if you already are seen in society as kind of being on the bottom, like maybe they don't actually care who your sexual partner is. So that's why I think that Belle and her lover have one of the best relationships in the book. And I'm not sure that that's historically accurate at all. In fact, I suspect queer historians could come for me and be like, that's not true. But this is like wishful thinking being projected into a book.
Sure. And then Minnie is kind of like our final main character, and she's more on the inside of the organization. What is her relationship like with the charity and with her family?
Yeah, so she's the daughter of one of the ministers who helped found this home. So she would have grown up with this idea of the home always in the background, but also growing up with this message that if you were in the home, you had done something wrong. So I think that we see her grappling with this internalization of what does it really mean to be a fallen woman? How are people treated differently based on their social class, based on their race? So she's very much a first wave feminist, right? Like, I think a lot of us look back on early feminism and see a lot of problems with it. But I wanted to have someone in the book who's maybe like slightly clapping back a little bit on some of the ways that the women in the home were talked about.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Now you've referenced this a few times. So a lot of this information is based off of a record book that you actually found and discovered in this house. And it kind of sent you on this journey. Can you tell us a little bit about this log, what was in it, and were there any women in there, like types of women that you wanted to include but didn't want to, you know, didn't have time for or space for?
Yeah. So I did an internship at a historical society in Louisville. And this is when I was working on my PhD. And before I took this internship, everyone was like, oh, I bet you'll find a topic for your dissertation. And I was like, well, I don't write historical fiction, but maybe. And then I spent a lot of my time doing like really funny organizing. Like they had this really extensive parasol collection. So they're like, can you organize our parasols? Which is really fun, by the way. So I was doing things like that. And then I also was helping the director of the museum unwrap paintings. And so when we unwrap paintings, since he knew all of this collection, he would just sometimes share information like, oh, this is Mrs. So-and-so. She was a big suffragist. And we unwrapped a painting one day and he's like, oh, this is Mr. So-and-so. He was a benefactor in the home for friendless women. And I just became completely obsessed with like, what is that? And so I had to write an article for my my PhD program. And so they had this box of all these materials from the home. And it had, yeah, the original record books. It had letters that people wrote where they'd say like, there's a young girl in my care. Can she come stay with you? And then they had newspaper articles. So like the newspaper spent a lot of time talking about what was happening in this home. Like this many garments have been mended by these women. Like stuff where you're like, how is this even printed in the newspaper, right? But it was like a lot of interest paid to these kinds of institutions. So after I wrote this article, I was still completely obsessed with the women I had read about in the books. I mean, I sometimes wish I could have had like 4 or 5 sections and just spent more time with different women, because the ones who emerged from the books were definitely the troublemakers, the ones who were like, you know, they did not want to be told to follow the rules, or they were running away, or like there was a whole scene where they were like, everyone needs to agree to abide by the rules, stand up. And then Belle, like in the record books, did not stand up. And I was just like, ooh, yeah, I like her, you know? So there was a couple of women like that, that if I was someone who wrote 800 page books, I probably would have included them as well.
Hmm. And you said a little bit about how the name, like the Home for Friendless Women, is kind of a euphemism for just kind of saying to society what this is. Can you tell us a little bit about like the history of when these started and when they kind of fell out of fashion? Because for Katie and I, like our aunt was at one of these. She got pregnant in her teens and she's in her 70s now, but like she went to one of these when she was a teenager. So it's like kind of a weird personal thing.
Yeah. Was that one of the maternity homes in like the 50s or the 60s?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's super fascinating. I've been kind of looking at this because it seems like they were really popular in the late 19th century up until the early 20th century. So like this particular home was 1876 to 1919, I think. Mm-hmm. And it seems like that time period, you saw a lot of these homes, right? And the reason for that feels a little murky. I sometimes think we could look at the Comstock Law. We could look at the criminalization of abortion, which, you know, it used to just be like a woman was free to do whatever she wanted until the point of quickening, right? And then that changed, things became illegal and were suddenly criminalized. So it seems like that might be one explanation for why there is suddenly all of these homes popping up. But then from like 1920 to the 1950s, I'm not sure who stepped in to fill that void. It's not that people suddenly weren't pregnant outside of marriage. I'm just not sure what happened. But then there was like this really robust maternity home business in the 50s and the 60s that, yeah, like what your aunt would have been a part of. And I know there's like lots of books out there about that. And there seemed to be a lot of callbacks to the Victorian era, although in the 50s and the 60s, I think something really terrible that happened was that women often had their children taken away from them without realizing that was happening. So they were not asked if they wanted to give up their kids for adoption. They were often just signing paperwork while they were still woozy from labor and drugs. And so a lot of times they had no idea that's what they had done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what would happen to these women? Was it different? Did they get the option to keep their babies? Like, what happened after they gave birth?
Yeah, it seems like they had different rules depending on the time period. So I think when they first opened, they didn't really have a lot of rules. And so it was sort of like a, you know, choose your own adventure. Like some women would keep their kids, some would give them up for adoption. Seems like there were a handful of women who would go out to work and leave their kids behind. And so then at a certain point, I think beginning in the 1880s, they decided that a woman needed to stay in the home for 18 months, that they needed to be there for their full reformation, and that they had to promise to take their children with them. Mm. So I think each home got to kind of make up their own rules.
Yeah, and these homes, they're supposed to be a safe place, right, for these women. Were they always safe places, or were there some dangerous things that took place?
That's such a great question. I don't fully know that. Like I remember reading in the book one time, they're like, everyone in the house is sick because of sewage. So, I mean, I'm sure there were times that like maybe the homes weren't as well maintained as they could be. And whether or not they were vulnerable to like people visiting the home, I'm not sure. I got the sense that they were actually a physically safe place. I don't know how emotionally or mentally safe it would be to have someone constantly telling you that you are a bad person, that you're sinful, that you need to reform your ways, you know, especially if you had been assaulted or, you know, just to have all of this heaped on you.
Mm-hmm. And were some of them there by choice, and were some of them there kind of by force? Like, how did these women end up here?
It seems, yeah, again, lots of different ways, right? So sometimes family members, I think, would escort them there. There was a person in the record books who said that she was a married woman of good standing. And I think she said that her husband kept wanting to have sex with her while she was pregnant and she was afraid she was going to miscarry. I think that was an exception. I think for the most part, family members or doctors would bring women there. Just because, especially if you were middle class, I think there was such a fear of falling in social class, and to be a pregnant, unmarried woman could bring dishonor to your family. So they had to be, you know, sheltered away.
What unique elements from you spending time in Louisville and this book being based there, like, is there any unique things about Kentucky that kind of shine through in this book?
Yeah, that's funny. One of my other friends asked me that. I do not love writing long, lengthy, like physical descriptions of place. That is not a strong suit of mine. But I did try to reference a few things so that it, you know, it was clear it was a Midwestern city, right? So they're by the river, and the home was in this. There's this really cool Victorian neighborhood in Louisville. It's in a neighborhood called Old Louisville. And a lot of those homes are still there, and they're very inexpensive, you know, considering you're buying like an 8-bedroom mansion. So I did try to reference that. So I think specifically if you live in Louisville, there might be certain things that you would notice, but I did not spend too much time having super specific Louisville or Kentucky details.
Yeah. Also sounds like the women in this story are a little busy to...
Yeah, exactly. They're not necessarily looking around at the scenery.
So we know that you have this log. Were there any other significant kind of research elements that you used to create this book?
Yeah, I found the newspaper to be a very helpful source. So I had access to it through the PhD program. And originally, I would just be like, how am I ever going to figure out what it was like to live in this time period? It's just a normal person. And so I would like Google certain terms, you know, it's like abortion, pregnancy, and those revealed nothing. But then once I figured out what the coded words were, so like you didn't get an abortion, you tried to remove an obstruction. And then when I did that, I would look at all the different products that were being sold to women for their health, for their nerves, and then looking at editorials. So what is it that people were super fired up about? And then you would get a sense of the conversations that people were having. So I think the newspapers, in addition to the records, played as big of a role.
Mm. And as modern day feminists, what do you want people to take away when they sit down to read this book?
I think the dangers of taking away bodily autonomy from half the population. I think that is such a frightening, terrifying thing. And I think most historical fiction writers would tell you that you're writing in the past in order to write about what's happening right now. And I think that became very clear as I was writing. And I actually wrote this book, before Roe was overturned. But I think, people around me have been saying, like, this right is being chipped away so steadily. It's very, very tenuous. And I think there's a lot of anger in the book. I think these women are really angry at their treatment. And I think I had a lot of anger in 2017, 2018, 2019 when I was writing this book as well. So, I hope that people can pretty clearly see that just because it happened 150 years ago doesn't mean that we have fully reconciled it or moved past it.
Mm-hmm. And is there a woman that you can think of that you maybe came across in your research, or even if it doesn't have anything to do with this story, that you would recommend we cover on the show? Someone who just really sticks out to you that you love to tell people about?
Yeah. Are y'all familiar with Marie Brochmand?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, no. So she was an impressionist artist, and she was really, really famous in her time. She was like a huge deal. Her paintings are beautiful, if you like impressionist work. And her husband was also an artist, and he really hated her art, and he hated that she made this art. And he did terrible things, like throw her artwork like outside of windows. When like people would come over, he would disparage her work, to the point that she just stopped creating art, period. And now when you talk about impressionist art, she's often left out of the conversation entirely, even though she was kind of a big deal in her time. So I think that would be someone who's super fascinating. Whenever I bring her up in class, my students are like, who? I'm like, Marie Brochmand, like write her name down. She should be like your passcode to log into your email, right? Like she's so interesting, and most of us just don't know about her.
That's great. It's nice to hear someone new.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I'm probably butchering her name because I don't speak French. So I want to, Google that and find out.
Yeah. Our number one question in 2018, when we started the show doing two women a week, people were like, are you going to run out of people? And we were like, nope.
No. You realize we are not gonna run out of people.
There's a lot of really cool women.
Yeah, exactly, who we do not know about. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, do you have any plans for other future historical fictions, or are you kind of done with the genre for right now?
No, like I'm working on another project, and it's kind of historical fiction, kind of not. I'm like super weird about talking about my projects because whenever I tell people, I would want them to be like, that's amazing. And then if they don't say that, I'm like, oof.
Yeah.
So I try not to actually like talk about what I'm writing so that I don't get too deep into my head. But this has historical fiction elements, but it's not as fully historical fiction as this is.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Okay. So this was released on March 19th and it is amazing. So can you tell all of our listeners where they can find this book, where they can find you, where they can order it so that everybody can be as excited about it as we are?
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, your local bookstore, you can ask them if they have it. My mom lives in Austin and she has been calling local bookstores pretending she's part of a book club that is reading this book. And she has got several bookstores to carry it.
Sure.
So you can do that. You can call your local bookstore. You can also find it on Amazon. I know I have several friends who kind of exclusively listen to audiobooks, and there's different voice actors for each section of the book, and they are all fantastic. So that's a really fun option too. And then I am kind of on social media. I have an Instagram author account. It's Kelly E. Hill 264. Kelly E. Oh my gosh. I told myself I was going to remember this. My poor publicist is always like, you need to be a little bit more. Okay, sorry. It's Kelly E. Hill _ author. Perfect. And I do sometimes post about the book there.
All right, perfect. Well, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about this. You know, I think, like you said, we talk a lot about the ones in the 50s, but not as much about these ones in the late 1800s. So it's such an important story to get out there. And we really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it.
Thanks for having me. This was so much fun.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Her Story on the Rocks. We are independently produced by 1986 Entertainment and proudly recorded in Baltimore, Maryland. If there's a woman in history you would like us to cover, you can email us at herstoryontherocks@gmail.com. You can also message us on Twitter or Instagram. We post all of our cocktail recipes on Tuesdays so that you can go get all the supplies you need and drink along with us. See you next week. Bye.